Hi, Art Supply Posse. Sometimes when I see the work of an artist that is new to me, I find myself wondering, how do they actually create such beautiful work? Especially when it is work that I've actually not experienced myself, something I've never tried to play with before. And our guest today, Alicia Jackson, is one of those. Her Instagram grid is full of her art, which at once appears both delicate and yet somehow strong at the same time. I don't know how she does that. Maybe we need to get to the bottom of that today. But I certainly found myself scrolling through that feed of hers, or that grid, or whatever the right word is. I can never remember. And I just became more enamored with what I was seeing, and that's why she's joining us today, because honestly, I just had to know more. Hello, Alicia. Welcome to the Art Supply Posse.
Oh, thank you. That was really lovely to hear.
So I want to jump in and ask you, how would you describe your current art practice?
Okay, so currently I create sculptures and wall hangings using basketry techniques. So I don't really view myself as a basket maker, although some people think that I am. I'm not. I don't actually make functional baskets, but I do use some basketry techniques. I'm quite new to fibre art, but yeah, it's something I've really been enjoying, and it's a new practice to me, so everything's kind of in that lovely, exciting stage.
So how, and that's probably a great time to talk about it because you are so new to this aspect of your artistic career, how did you find it? How did you become so passionate about it? Like, what is it, what pulled you in?
Yeah, I've always painted and drawn for most of my life, and I've been a practicing artist for more than 20 years. I was reaching a stage, though, with my painting where I was craving a different sort of creative outlet. And the reason for that was that my painting is very, very strong in detail. And that's really hard. Like, it's really, really hard work. And because I was pushing myself to become better with each piece, it reached a point where I was kind of losing the sense of play in my work, and it just kind of often felt like just hard work, and that's no good, of course. So I was searching for a different avenue, kind of just at the back of my mind, not really actively searching. And then at the start of our lockdowns, because here in Melbourne we had really heavy lockdowns, I was looking for just a mindful hobby, and a lovely ceramic artist actually that I follow on Instagram, Kristen Olds, she also does a little bit of coil weaving. And I saw that on her page, and she was offering these really simple video kits with handmade raffia for people to do as a hobby during lockdown. And so I grabbed one of those, and I had no idea that I would fall so hard for it. And I just wove obsessively, just that one technique, coil weaving, for about a year. And then from there, I got really curious about other basketry techniques, and I did further online studies and got taught by some lovely, clever Australian artists. And yeah, here I am.
So that's pretty incredible that you've gone from one type of medium to another through the world of online learning, which is, you know, we're in a place where now where we've just never been before, when so much is open to us, where we can, you know, take on board so many different things, and have people from all around the world access to them. Like in your case, they were Australian, fellow Australian artists, but you know, they're certainly not like you couldn't have or could in the future, you know, learn from others, or goodness me, you could even teach others yourself via that same sort of thing. And I think that's pretty special.
It really, really is. So I'm so, so grateful for it. And yeah, I did eventually, like throughout the lockdowns, I held little Zoom classes with people, and like friend groups would get together and all weave together from their various locations. And it's not the same. It's never the same as learning next to somebody in person, but it was a beautiful alternative. And yeah, it is quite remarkable, I think, that I did do all of that online. Not remarkable of me, but just that, yeah, we have access to all of that. Like you say, it's pretty cool.
Do you think if it wasn't for the lockdowns, which, you know, affected us in so many different ways, but do you think if it wasn't for that, like obviously you were feeling you needed to move on from the painting practice, but do you think you would have taken to the next thing, so in this case, that you know, the weaving, the basketry, the fibre art, do you think you would have been able to have dedicated that much time to learning it if it wasn't for the lockdown? Like in some ways, has that what lockdown helped in a way?
I'm not sure. Probably not so much, although it did help me to get immersed in it, I suppose, more so than I would have because I was spending so much time at home. But I was really looking for a way to monetize my work as well. Mm-hmm. I was selling my paintings, but they were difficult to sell. They were quite niche, and each piece took many, many hours. And so when I popped like one of the very first things that I wove up onto Instagram, and everybody wanted to buy it. And I thought, well, this could be something. And it just sort of all fell into place for me to be able to sell my work and be able to justify the time that I do put into creative pursuits, because it's all I ever really want to do all of the time. And realistically, if that's the case, I really do need to be making money from it, of course. So yeah, I think the progression kind of just happened naturally. I'm not really sure if lockdowns influenced that. I think it probably would have happened anyway. Yeah.
So you did describe, and it's perfect really, you described the work as sculptures because that's certainly what they are. How do those shapes come to be? Now, bearing in mind I have no idea about basketry, no idea about weaving, none of that. So I'm very, I don't know what the right word is, like, I have no idea how any of these things are sort of formed. Like, you know, but the shapes that you manage to pull out of this material are just incredible. And I guess that's where I sort of feel this combination of the strength and also the delicate nature of them. How do those sort of shapes come to be?
Oh, thank you. I do prefer to let the shapes grow organically. I'll usually start out with an idea of where I'm headed, but I do find that the best shapes come about if I just start weaving, because all of my vases start in exactly the same way, and then they grow. And yeah, I do kind of let it do its own thing as much as I can. On saying that, I do sometimes replicate work, but it's never quite as good. It's always better just to let the shapes grow. I don't know. Yeah, organically is the best way I can describe it, I suppose.
Is it dependent on the actual material you're using? Like, does some work better than others?
Yeah, well, not better, but just differently. So I mostly use paper string. I use a variety, but paper string will be the one that you see the most. And it's just a really marvellous fibre because it is both strong and delicate, kind of like how you described. It's malleable and it's strong, strongish. Yeah, and then I think maybe the unfurling of the paper string at the ends, which is a common technique that I use, is what really appeals to people and kind of adds to that more feminine, delicate nature. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question? Sorry.
You did. Absolutely, you did. Because this is the thing, like, I feel kind of I just feel a bit weird because I have no experience at all and I'm like, I don't even know how you would make these things. Like, it just... It's such a an unknown for me, and that's why I'm sort of like, gosh, am I asking questions that Alicia's just thinking, no, these are silly.
No, not at all. There's no silly questions.
So obviously the fibre is, I guess, a big aspect in what where a shape goes, what where a piece, you know, where it's how it comes about. Is there any sort of other factors like the colour of what it is or anything else?
Yeah, I like to incorporate dark colours. Like I really love when I work with black string and navy blue string. I find that those pieces are usually also more masculine perhaps in shape, and that's kind of just more strong. And yeah, now that you've asked me that question, I think that that is true. Yeah, perhaps the darker colours tend to be a little more masculine and the paler colours more feminine, or stronger and softer. Materials definitely are the biggest thing. Like I find that if I'm ever stagnating creatively, finding a new fibre to work with is the key to getting myself out of that. It'll completely influence how the piece comes out and spark new ideas.
So how do you go about finding a new material to use?
By foraging, yeah.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. So there are plenty of fibres in our beautiful Australian landscape that we can use, and I got taught as part of I did an online course with Harriet Goodall called Finding Free. Oh goodness, now I've forgotten the name of the course, but if you hop onto Harriet Goodall's page, then you'll see links to her amazing course, which is fiber art for artists or sculptural fiber art using basketry techniques. So I learned a few techniques from her, but she also delved into foraging and what fibers can be used. But it's one of those things that it's best to just go out and look for stuff and let it dry and then use it. And sometimes you'll see a few things that are already dried out there in nature that you can pick and use straight away. I use seaweed and I'm just always looking for, as I'm driving along, it's probably a bit dangerous, but usually when I'm driving along, I'll look around and try and see what I can pinch. And using my art.
I think that's common, that art thing of like that artist eye is always on. You're always looking,
always.
You're always searching something out. Even subconsciously, I think it's just something that we do.
Definitely, yeah. And that was the case too. As soon as I really started getting very serious about my art at the age of 15, I always have had that artist lens on. You're just always looking at light and faces and everything through an artist's eye, aren't you?
So let's say you've had a session, you've gone foraging, you've found some bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
What, like, how do you store them for drying? Is it, like, in my brain it's hanging from a ceiling, but is that practical? Like, let's talk about it, because, of course, you know, we are called the Art Supply Posse, so I want to sort of take it to the thing of like the storing and the looking after, like, because I'm going to guess the fact that it's a natural fiber means it's totally different than if you were, you know, using something that was plastic or whatever. Like, how do you go about all that sort of thing?
Yeah, so you're right, hanging it from the ceiling is very commonly done, and it's a really good way to do it, in bunches usually, and then as you harvest leaves and things and they do dry, they will shrink, so you'll have to tighten your binding. Every fibre takes a different amount of time to dry. You want to keep it out of any sort of humid or damp conditions, because they can go mouldy, of course. So not such a problem here in Melbourne, but elsewhere in Australia it can be really problematic. I rent and I work from home, so I can't always hang things from the ceiling. I often use over-the-door hooks, and I hang all of my stuff on that. And then once the fibre is completely dry, usually you will have to then dampen the fibre or even soak it, and then work with it kind of wet or damp. and then it will naturally dry as it as it goes.
That's fascinating. I never even thought of that. So, like, you're drying it, but then you need to make it damp again.
Yeah, otherwise it will be too brittle. Yeah,
pretty brittle.
So a nice little rule of thumb too, like if people are interested in this, is with soft, strappy leaves. Harriet Goodall did describe it as literally the rule of thumb. If you can wrap that soft leaf around your thumb while it's green, then it will most likely be able to be woven with the exception of agapanthus leaves, that that doesn't usually work. There's not enough fiber in those. But yes, and then you let them dry completely, and that will usually take roughly 6 weeks. That's very rough, but thereabouts. And
then
you can get weaving. Yeah, some things you can weave with immediately, but those are less common.
So I'm curious to know: is there anything, like, have you ever been out foraging and found something that caught your eye? You fell in love with it, but then after the process of letting it to dry, it just didn't give you what you were hoping it would give? It just didn't work out?
Yes, yeah. And then, funnily enough, that's usually a good thing because it'll turn into something else completely unexpected. So that happened just very recently, actually. I made a little nesty bowl sort of thing out of smoke bush flowers. And when I harvested them over a year ago, I really, really thought that I would use them to decorate a paper string basket, like around the edges, like a bit of a fringe, I suppose. And then I left it to dry, and it kind of got all squished or dried in a great big thick mat. And when I tried to use it how I originally intended, it didn't work at all. But then because it was all kind of matted together, it made me think of, what if I deliberately matted these pieces together and wove them into a bowl or like a nest? And I've been watching birds a lot lately too, so nests have been on my mind.
Yeah.
And that's what I did with it. And, it came out really lovely. And now I'm obsessively hunting for more smoke bush flowers so that I can do a really, really big sculptural piece in a similar technique.
Well, you've just made me think, like, how big can you go with fibre art?
It depends on the fibre, of course, because the biggest risk is that it will, with paper string especially, is that it will collapse under its own weight the bigger you get. And that has happened through trial and error. And I find that sealing it with a product called encaustic wax hardens it, and that works really well. I haven't really pushed the limits into really, really big works with paper string, but you know, you can jump online and you can see these incredible creations of like tree houses that are woven. So long as the technique is right and the structure is sound, you can go as big as a house, I suppose.
This is probably going to be a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How do you keep them clean? That's always my thing with, like, I just see dust. And that could just be because where I live particularly is super dusty, my town. Like, we're just known for dust storms and all those sorts of things. Maybe in Melbourne you're not quite as, you know, it's not quite as bad as it is for me, but I see so many beautiful things that I want and then I'm like, oh, but the dust. Yeah. Like, how do you clean them? How do you look after them? Because surely you just don't want them set in a glass cabinet to never really be appreciated.
Yeah. I understand. And I have some people say to me at markets and stuff, oh, that they're just dust collectors. So I understand. I just clean them, dust them with a feather duster. Okay. And that works really, really well because it can get in between all of the gaps. You can also use like a hairdryer on the cold setting just to blow the dust away. But generally speaking, just often with a feather duster works really well. And I often suggest to my customers too that every 3 months or so they give it a bit of a spray with like a spray varnish that you can get from art supply stores or even some hairspray, and that just keeps it looking nice and fresh and in one place.
Nice. That's really cool. I'm sort of thinking, again, and I'm thinking back at looking at your Instagram grid, is when you are creating a new piece, do you sort of create for like a specific theme in mind, or are they just a loose sort of theme because they're all made by you? Like, you know how like sometimes you can see a body of work and you go, yes, this artist sat down and they had intention to make 10 pieces in this style. Like, does that sort of work with you and how you create or not?
Yeah, I do like to go with themes, but only sometimes. So, like, I have something that I call my artifact collection, and I don't have a set limit of how many pieces I'm going to make within that collection, but it's pieces usually which include Plaster of Paris. I'm not sure if you saw those works on my Instagram. And the idea is that they kind of look as though you've just dug them up from the earth and it's some sort of strange artifact that you've uncovered. And so anything really that I make with Plaster of Paris will usually fall under that collection. And I never started out with that goal. It kind of happened by accident when I started playing with Plaster of Paris. I thought, oh, this looks like it's just been dug up. And then other people started saying the same thing. So that sparked the interest to explore that theme. But no, generally speaking, I'm not really interested in themes. I kind of have a little bit of a short attention span, so I like to just play and do whatever wants to happen, really.
Well, I think it's interesting you mentioned the Plaster of Paris pieces, because that is bringing in another medium. It's bringing in another, like, way of creating these works. And I find that such a fascinating thing, like, because it's bringing another aspect of you and what you do to the table, but just in a different, or utilizing a different medium. Like, you can still see it's Alicia's work, but it's a slight variation of that. And I'm with you. I would get bored if I stuck to one thing. Like, heaven knows, I think I've said this literally every episode to Slightly. I'm sure the listeners are absolutely sick of hearing it. I can't just focus on one thing. Like, I need different mediums, different artworks on the go at any one time, or I'm just, I'm out of there. And I guess in a way that's kind of what you're doing too, with bringing in the, you know, the other mediums into the weaving work.
Yeah, I totally understand, and I'm the same. And if you're losing interest, then what's the point, really? You've got to keep it fun. The Plaster of Paris came about because I not so secretly dream of being a ceramic artist or a potter. But for various reasons, mostly that I can't really afford to get obsessed with another thing that would be costly, because I'd be all in. And so I don't feel as though I'm in the position to be all in for something like that. So I've often thought, and most of my creative ideas do stem from this question of what if. And so I thought, when looking at one of my paper string vases, oh, what if this was clay? How can I make it look like clay? And I remembered, it just sprung to mind that I had YouTubed some Plaster of Paris hobbies to do with kits when I was looking after my niece and nephew one time. And that was years ago, but it just popped into my mind when I asked that what if question, Plaster of Paris. And so I went down to Bunnings and got a bag and jumped into it. And it's a very, very, very tricky medium to work with, but it's been quite rewarding. I really like how they come out.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the ones that I did see, and it's almost as if, well, you're right about that artifact feel. Like it's growing out of something. I can't really describe it. This is not ideal on an audio medium, but it feels like they're kind of growing and weaving their way out of of the solidness of the plaster of Paris.
Oh, wow, cool. That's a nice way to describe it.
Do you think, is it possible that other types of mediums could be utilized within the work as well? Or are you sort of, like, again, this is me coming back to not having done basketry, weaving, any of that sort of stuff. Like, is it limited at all in any way as a medium? Like, is there only so much you can do with it? Or is it sort of got, does it have no boundaries?
No, I don't think there are any boundaries. I think your only boundaries would be limited by what you believe you can do. And I had some of those limiting beliefs in the beginning when I was kind of thinking about my practice as basket making as opposed mm-hmm. to art using basketry techniques. So when I shifted my perspective, it opened up a whole new world, because when I was thinking of it through a basketry lens, there are a lot of rules behind traditional basketry, and you wouldn't use glue, for example, if you were making a traditionally made basket to hold anything in place. That would be a no-no. That wouldn't be a good, like, a good basket maker or a very good basket maker. And so when I was thinking along those lines, yeah, it was very limiting. And then when it all of a sudden just I had that, oh, duh, moment when I went, but I'm not a basket maker. Like, I'm an artist and I can do whatever I want. And once I had that light bulb moment, that was it. It changed everything. If I want to use a hot glue gun, I just will. And yeah, I suppose in any creative practice, just the act of making is what really does spark new ideas, and that's where the source of inspiration comes from. So I'm hoping that I'll keep growing and finding new ways to incorporate other things. We'll see.
You mentioned, I did see one of your Instagram posts about the difficulties, the trickiness of working with others, like for commissions, and it's certainly mm-hmm. something people have touched on before. How do you go about sort of balancing what the client needs but also what you need? Because the key, you said when you moved from painting to this, is you were no longer feeling that joy within your art, and that's the point of it.
Yeah.
So does working as a commissioned artist change that in any way?
Does it change the joy, do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it really can, for sure. Yeah. And especially because, as I mentioned earlier, my preferred way of creating is to let the piece organically grow mm-hmm. rather than to mm-hmm. try and force it into a particular way that I think it should go. So, yes, it can lose joy, and it can also lose spontaneity. Like, one follower said that it loses its magic when
oh, yeah.
you put those limitations, and, like, I really understood where she was coming from with that. There's a sort of a magic in the unexpected when you let something organically grow as opposed to trying to stick to a particular template. What I found that really helps is before I even start sort of getting into conversations with clients about commissions, I do say to them that I can make something look very similar to something you've already seen me make, but nothing will ever be completely the same, and each piece is unique, and that I prefer to work organically, and I let them know, and I find that usually they're going to be the sort of person that gets that because they've yeah. found my work and it speaks to them. So that takes a lot of the pressure off. Well, it takes some of the pressure off. I think I still load a fair bit of pressure on myself to get it to be exactly what they want. I also too will, if it's just a vase that they're after, which is reasonably quick for me to make, I'll make them two or three and give them an option. Mm-hmm. And then that way I know that whatever they choose, they'll really love, rather than just taking the one that I gave to them and it might not be quite exactly what they want. And then I just sell the others. And that has helped a lot too, to keep it a little bit more expressive and to lessen the pressure on myself to get it exactly so.
Yeah, I can see how that would work, because you're letting your joy and the spontaneity of the fibre come through, but by giving them a couple of options, even though they've expressed a desire and a want to have a piece of your work, but specifically commission to whatever it is that they're after, giving them a couple of choices gives them that slight freedom of falling. Because usually, I will usually fall in love with one thing. You know, someone presented me with three vases, seems that's what we're talking about. I'm going to fall in love with one of them more than the other two, generally.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I don't, and then I buy all three. Like, you know, that could happen too, I guess. But at least they have the option, and then you have the added bonus of going, great, now I've got two more completed pieces that I can then sell.
Yeah, yeah. And that's such a unique thing that I can do within this world of art making that I couldn't do with paintings and drawings, because, well, you know, I've done many commissions over the years, always portraits, and I can't whip up three highly detailed portraits for them to choose from. That's impossible. And yeah, I could never resell them, right?
No, exactly.
So that opened up a whole new avenue of me being okay with commissions, because I can do that. It does, there's less risk. Even if the commission falls through, because that's always a big risk, isn't it? Like,
mm-hmm,
you have some dodgy customers sometimes who won't pay at the end, or,
yep,
you know, make up reasons. And if you've made a portrait of their grandmother,
yeah, what are you going to do with that?
What are you going to do with it? You literally have stolen your time, and yeah, you'll never get it back. So, yeah, it's. I really love that even if a commission goes badly, I can still sell whatever I make.
Yeah. I think you've pretty much found the perfect way to do commissions.
Yeah. Well, look, even on saying all of that, I still do need to take a break from them from time to time.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And, I mean, I think that's normal, because, you know, we're creative people, we're artistic people. We go in wanting everything to be perfect, because heaven forbid it's not. Like, that's just standard. But what we're doing is applying already all this other pressure, and then you've got another party involved who's simply there because they love your work, but they don't realize that you've got all your own external, like your own internal things. Like, it's a weird space to be in, but it's also a really good space, because, like, if you can work with someone who already loves you, what you're doing, but just wants to next level it to something sort of tailored to them, they are, in many ways, they're going to be your best advocate, because they're going to be telling everybody they can, you know, whose ear they can bend, look at this thing that Alicia created for me. I gave her some input. I suggested maybe this shape or colour or whatever the case, excuse me, may be, but she created this thing. Yeah, I just think they are your best advocate in that situation when it all goes right.
Yes, that's true. It's a very powerful word of mouth thing. And it's funny too, like sometimes the client can make a suggestion that I never ever would have thought of on my own.
Yeah.
And even if it's just something simple like a colour, I had one client commission a wall hanging using pink raffia. And I don't like pink, and I thought, oh, this is going to be awful. No, I didn't think that. I knew it would be nice, but it wouldn't be me.
Yeah.
But she ended up choosing this beautiful soft pink, and I made the wall hanging, and it was lovely. And people on Instagram loved it, and I had a few more commissioned in the same colour, and I never ever would have done that. So sometimes it can even spark creativity,
yes,
rather than,
well,
just tampering.
She's gently pushed you out of your comfort zone. You've used a colour you don't particularly like, so therefore you avoid it, like we all do that.
Yeah.
And yet the end result has been worth it. And it's nice when that happens from an outsider that's, you know, an appreciated person of your work and who loves what you do, as opposed to it always being you thinking about pushing yourself. Like, it's nice when it comes from an outside source.
that's really true.
I like that. That's nice to learn that, you know, that you can be pushed in a way that you may not have been. And, you know, now you've discovered that, okay, soft pink raffia is okay.
Yeah. And I do like being pushed in those unexpected directions, and it kind of relates to a pet topic of mine, which is mistakes and how much I enjoy making mistakes. But it's the same
tell
principle.
Me more. Tell me more. let's go down that rabbit hole. I need to know more.
Yeah, you know, we're all so afraid of failure, of course, and we can hold ourselves back in so many ways because we're afraid of failing or making a mistake. But I have genuinely found that the absolute best, most innovative, creative, unusual things that I've made have stemmed from a mistake that I've then tried to fix. So just for example, I made a plaster of Paris vase, and as I was photographing it outside on a windy day, it fell off of the tree trunk I had placed it on and just cracked in a million pieces.
Oh.
Now, I could have freaked out, and a tiny little bit of me did, but mostly I was really excited. Like, I just had this huge buzz of excitement because I knew, okay, I'm not going to chuck this out. What am I going to do? How am I going to repair it? And then that line of questioning came up with three or four different ways that I could do that. And I ended up binding it with some cord that I had made from freesia leaves. So I bound the broken bits in a different contrasting fibre. But that's just one example of where you can take a mistake or a failure and turn it into something else that you never, ever, ever would have thought of. It's completely spontaneous, and it can't ever be forced or replicated. It has to happen naturally from that mistake. And so, yeah, I kind of, because it's turned out so well for me, I kind of get addicted to making mistakes now. Like, I want something weird and bad to happen so that it can shoot me off into another direction that I wouldn't be able to come up with on my own.
So can you then take a piece that's plaster of Paris and, like, just throw it in the air and see what happens?
I could. Maybe I should do that, and I'll film it and put it on Instagram and everybody will freak out.
Yeah, they will, but it'll be fun.
Yeah, sure will. Actually, I should do that. I'll keep you in the loop.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, so you've, in that case, and that's one thing of it, because it's fallen when it shouldn't have. But then in a kind of way, by throwing it up and just letting it drop and break, you're not replicating it, but you sort of are. You're getting that, you know, you're getting it's broken, I guess.
Yeah.
But then it's going to present a whole new set of challenges on how to then turn it into something, like how to salvage it, so to speak, because it's going to break in a different way. Like, you know, you could hit something with 10 different things with a hammer, and each 10 different thing is going to break in a different way.
Yeah, that's so true. And, yes, it brings in a wild element that's completely out of your control, even though you did technically control the breaking of the piece. It's still not going to break where you perhaps want it to, or think it should be. So,
well, in a way, it kind of suits the material, because it is such, you know, you describe taking a fibre and hoping it will become a thing, but it may not, and you just let it go there. So in a way, breaking it and then rebuilding it, it sort of all feels like it ties in nicely. Maybe there's a new theme for you.
Perhaps, yeah. I'll mull over that one. I thought about things like that. Like, I created a little video for Instagram, and it was ephemeral art. And I'm not interested in going down that route so much. But it was interesting that, like, that's a whole thing that can spark within a person to just find a completely new concept and go down that road. And yeah, broken things. Interesting.
Well, I think the thing about incorporating your mistakes, thriving with the mistakes, is it, whilst I can see it may probably at a point be a little bit stressful or a little bit concerning. It would hold that joy, like that creativity, you know, because what if, like how, what if? And that's, I think that sort of would keep that spark going.
Yeah, definitely. And that question, what if, it is my absolute favourite, and it is next to mistakes, usually what will take me down a new path that I hadn't ordinarily considered. And it can be something just really, really simple, like I make these mobiles, and I'm not the first person, of course, to make a woven mobile, but they weren't really on my radar. I was just playing around with one of my vases, and often I'll just pick them up and move them around and look at them from different angles, and I turned one upside down and I thought to myself, oh, well, what if the bottom was the top, and mm-hmm. I made these bulbs that went down, and then I made these mobiles, and that wasn't obviously my weaving in that fashion. It's not my idea originally, but that's where it stemmed from in my case. And that took me into a whole other realm of different shapes and incorporating different materials.
See, for me, that's one of the most important things about being creative, is that experimentation and play and just letting it do what it does.
Yeah, so important. Yeah.
Play. So how would you suggest to somebody who would like to give this a go, like they would like to learn the basics of weaving and go from there, like what would you suggest to them? Do they need to spend a fortune on materials and courses, or like to dip their toe in the water? How is the best way for someone to go about it?
So my first recommendation is to start with coil weaving. And I suggest mm-hmm. that because it's just a beautiful practice. I think we all are looking for mindful practices in life. We know that it's really good for us. And it's very, very, very slow. And it's easy. Like, I really believe that everybody can do this. It's a very, mm-hmm. very easy thing to pick up. It's very repetitive. It's a little bit tricky when you first get started, of course, but once the muscle memory kicks in, that's it. And you can usually find tutorials on YouTube for free for how to do coil weaving as well. Raffia is the material that I would suggest you use, and that's also inexpensive, and a little goes quite a long way. So, like, fiber art can be dear. Like, if you knit a jumper, for example, it can cost you hundreds of dollars. Yeah, it's really expensive, whereas the fibres that you use in basketry can be free because you can go out and forage them yourselves, or they can be reasonably inexpensive, things like raffia and paper string aren't terribly dear. So that would be my suggestion. Start out with coil weaving. Just find a YouTube tutorial, which will be free. I do have a post. It's the first one that's pinned on my Instagram account, where I've compiled a list of resources. Learning to weave, because I get asked all the time, do you run workshops, do you teach, where can I learn? That's the biggest question I get asked. So I compiled this list of resources, and I've got some free links. Well, actually, I don't have the free links there, but you can always Google YouTube videos. But also just connections to artists around the world who run online workshops and that sort of thing.
So I'm also curious to know if someone wants to go looking in their backyard for materials, is there anything they need to keep in mind?
If it's in their own backyard, no, not really. that rule of thumb that I mentioned earlier for soft, strappy leaves. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, for more hardy sort of things, you're looking at vines, things like ivy. You want to be wearing gloves when you're dealing with fibres that you've not used before, just in case they're a bit spiky or whatever. So ivy's a really it's usually very accessible. It's usually growing everywhere. So that's one thing that you could start off with. And then you can actually weave with ivy right away because it doesn't shrink very much. The problem, the reason that we dry things first is because they shrink as they dry. So if you were to weave with fresh vines or fresh leaves, it would lose all of its shape and its integrity as it dries. So you have to dry it first and then weave with it. But there are some exceptions to that rule. One is cordyline leaves. They're ready to use straight away if you pick the dry ones at the bottom of the trees. And ivy doesn't shrink very much, so you can kind of weave with that right away. But if you're out and about and you're foraging and just like picking off the side of the road or something, just only take what you need. Be mindful of leaving enough there. I only really take from areas that are quite bountiful so that I'm not pinching anything that somebody will miss. That's about it, really.
Do you have a favourite fibre?
Paper string is my favourite fibre, definitely, yeah.
Yep.
Most of my work incorporates that somehow. The reason that I chose that fibre was that I was looking to make things that I could sell. And I wanted to be able to sell to people overseas. But even within Australia, throughout the postal system, there are a lot of fibres that you're not allowed to send. And that's especially the case when you go overseas as well. Like I wouldn't be able to send any of my baskets that I have forage materials in really anywhere. And I want to respect those rules. So that was one of the large reasons why I've gone with paper string, because that's something that is easy enough for me to get my hands on and that I can make and send it to anybody. And I don't have anyone anywhere in the world that I can't send it to. So that's one nice thing about it.
Nice. So I'm going to guess then, if you get asked a question all the time and you have a pin, you don't do any teaching, would that be right?
Not at the moment. I did do some Zoom workshops, like I said before, over lockdown. But I really did that because I really like the idea of being able to help people endure all of our lockdowns. And it was very much out of my comfort zone. I'm really very introverted, so I'm always going to prefer to be on my own. But I did really enjoy those classes that I held. And I've had some students as well who still, a couple of years later, send me stuff that they make, and they're just so grateful that they have this skill. So it's been nice. I do plan to hold some workshops and things eventually. It's always at the back of my mind that I'd like to do that. But I feel like I'm still very much a novice myself. So there is a little bit of that imposter syndrome thing happening where I don't feel like I'm teacher status, but I can share what I know for sure. So it's
Yeah, that's the thing. Okay, so you have maybe only been doing it a few years, but if I look at you, I've never done it at all. So what you know is way more than I – like, do you know what I mean? Like, there's always somebody – in my situation who has no idea. And I think, of course, like, you want to be comfortable and confident with the skills you're sharing, but you don't have to know every skill under the sun. You don't have to do everything. You don't have to be doing it for 20 years before you can offer instruction. That's just me throwing in my 10 cents worth there. Like, there's always someone in my position who wants to start and is comfortable to, or is in the position to pay to learn. And I just would say, just don't forget that. that's just my gentle little reminder of just forget that there's always someone in that situation. And I'm not trying to push you into something you don't want to do either, but I am just saying, you've just got to remember, everybody, there's always someone who's just starting out, and you know what you know is way more than they know.
And you're absolutely right. Just because I haven't been doing it for years and years doesn't mean I can't teach a beginner level class. I certainly have learned enough to do that. So, yes, I'll keep that in mind.
That's just my way of ending the conversation by giving you a little spank over the wrist and just saying, listen here, Alicia, you can do more than you think you can. And I'm just going to squash that imposter that's giving you those thoughts.
Duly noted. Thank you.
Look, we all have it, don't worry. This conversation has just had my brain going in places. I didn't think it would go this afternoon, and I'm so thrilled. I'm truly thinking of what I have got that I can break or tear up and turn into something else. I actually know I did a, just totally unrelated to anything, I helped show a friend's daughter how to do some paw painting on the weekend. Mm-hmm. I dislike what I've got. What I made, just sometimes it happens, and I plan on actually taking it off the canvas and cutting it up and see what I can do with it.
Oh, good. Because
I'm like, it's there. Let's see what happens.
Yeah,
nothing's going to hurt.
Yeah. It's funny. I did exactly that, and it's probably the first mistake where I went, oh yeah, mistakes are great. Was exactly what you've said. I had a drawing that I didn't like, but I liked part of it. And I cut that part of it out, and then I fell into collages, which is was just an exciting new realm that I've never considered before. So yeah, go have lots of fun. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm excited to hear where it takes me.
I shall keep you posted. Let's finish, Alicia, by you letting everybody know the best place for them to find you.
Sure. So Instagram is my name, Alicia, Elishia dot Jackson Art. I think I always forget where the dot is. And from there, there's a link in my profile that can take you to my Etsy shop. I don't have a website currently, but Instagram and Etsy are serving me really well for now. So that's where you can find me.
That's the most important thing. Thank you so much, Alicia. I really love this conversation, and thank you so much for making time.
Thank you. Thanks for making it easy for me. It's been a pleasure.
If we were to provide you with some PayPal details or perhaps Buy Me a Coffee details, would you be interested in making a one-off payment to support us? In return, you'd be helping to keep the podcast going and would also get access to our bonus episodes. Let me know what you think via Kim at artsupplyposse.com or via Instagram.